Let's caucus today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. If you're not quite sure how that whole caucus thing works in Iowa, we've got some help. This reporter refers us to a 70s kids game show in Britain called Runaround.
Kids have to dash across a TV studio and they line up behind an answer that they want to say is correct. And then at the last minute, they all change sides to try and foil the opposition. So I think people can expect some shenanigans tonight.
Plus, looks like cycling's got another doping problem, only this time it's not the riders using drugs, it's bikes with tiny hidden motors.
Pretty much as soon as the people who are in the industry said, oh, there's absolutely no way that this is possible, that's the point at which I thought it was possible.
Adding a forbidden push to pedal power, that and more today on The World. Glad you could be with us. We begin today with Europe's migrant crisis. The migrants keep coming, even in bad weather. And for migrants living in camps throughout Europe, winter means miserable conditions, mud everywhere, and unheated tents. That's the case for residents of one camp in Grand Sainte in northern France. It's a launching point for people hoping to make it to Britain, often illegally. The town is working on plans to relocate people to a better-equipped site, but for now, it's up to NGOs and local volunteers to care for the camp residents. Adeline Sia has a story from Grand Sainte.
The local charity Salam cooks hundreds of meals a week at the camp. They have an all-volunteer workforce, social workers in training, teenage interns, and retirees, like Henri Kubzik.
K-U-P-C-Z-Y-K. Au Scrabble, c'est vous gagnez 50 points direct.
If you play Scrabble with those letters, you'll score 50 points immediately.
Kubzik tells me he's fascinated by all the faraway countries he's gotten close to through his work at the camp.
Vous... Vous couvrez la France.
You cover France, but we are practically 5 days a week in Iraq, in Syria. We travel a lot.
Kubzik misses the days when the camp was home to just a few dozen people at a time.
We used
to know those people well. It's funny, we even made friends there. But now it's impossible. In 3 months' time, their number went up to 2,000. It's more difficult.
Last summer, masses of people began to arrive, and Françoise Lavoisier, the coordinator of Salam, says as the numbers grew, things got out of hand. When there were only about 100 people, it was a lot more manageable, you know? For cleaning, you could just tell a couple of guys, look, you need to pick up the trash. But now, it's a whole different setup. They say the camp is about a tenth the size of Grand Sainte, so it's a village within the town. So when international NGOs like Doctors Without Borders came to help last fall, she was relieved at first. But individual volunteers began to show up too, like Tally Oliver from the UK.
I got all my friends to give me money, clothes, food, put it all in my car and drove here to meet somebody I'd never met before and decided to help.
Oliver has been distributing toiletries and hundreds of water bottles. She's also working with a British man who runs a mobile kitchen at the camp. They're providing a real service, but Françoise Lavoisier says because no one's managing all these volunteers, it can get chaotic.
C'est l'anarchie complètement.
It's total anarchy, she says. Everyone comes and goes and brings stuff without consulting others. They all think that before they arrived in September, when they saw the photo of that Syrian little boy dead on the beach, there was no help on site. So they all take this position of world savior. And that leads to a lot of waste. She says food, blankets, and clothing wind up in the trash. But there are darker issues at the camp that preoccupy Lavoisier. It's the suspicion that human smugglers live on site among the migrants, charging them for services the city provides for free, like making them pay for taking a shower. The town's mayor says he wants to root out the smuggler gangs, but Lavoisier says it's almost impossible to know who they are because the migrants won't say.
Il y a des choses qu'on voit, des choses qu'on entend, mais c'est pas des preuves.
We see and hear things, she says, but we don't have proof. It's something we just get a sense for. Last week, gunfire erupted at the camp between suspected smugglers. Despite incidents like this, most people in town have been tolerant, even welcoming of the migrants. But that doesn't mean everyone feels good about the camp's presence. Residents living near the camp complain about litter, and some women say they are afraid to go out on their own. But for the volunteers, like Maryse Facon, it's the misery of the people at the camp that haunts them.
Pendant trois semaines, j'étais plus capable de venir sur le camp.
For 3 weeks, I was unable to come to the camp because I was too distraught psychologically. I had nightmares. I even thought of stopping this work. Then I conquered this fear. It's not always easy, but you have to do it. For Teresina Facella, though, working with the migrants has been a life-changing experience.
Seulement mon migrant, ça me faisait peur.
The very mention of the word migrants used to scare me, and I passed my fear on to my children and my friends. I used to stay awake at night. But I got over that, and I'm very happy. And even though the work can be overwhelming, the volunteers of Salam have no plans to stop. For the world, Adeline Cyr, Grande Sainte, France.
We've all heard about the attacks on women in Cologne, Germany on New Year's Eve, apparently involving organized groups of migrants. It's made some Germans rethink their country's welcome policy for refugees. On that same night, that same New Year's Eve night, in the same city, different migrants, unaware of what was happening outside, were living their dream. For these young Syrians, the trek to safety became a music tour. Rebecca Collard caught up with them in Berlin.
On New Year's Eve, Anas Maghrebi and his band, Hobiz Daule, played for a packed theater in Cologne.
When you're on stage, you start to think, where am I exactly? What is this land? What is this city? Why am I here?
This wasn't how Maghrebi had expected to be spending this New Year's Eve. Maghrebi started Hobiz Daule in Damascus in late 2012, when he was still optimistic about the Syrian uprising. Hobiz Daule literally means government bread, the type the state provides at a subsidized cost.
It used to mean to Syrian people a lot more than just food. It has this symbolic meaning. Stability, safety, independency. As long as this bread is available, then everything's okay. It's great. It's delicious. I miss the taste, actually. But it's not enough.
For a while, Maghrebi produced and uploaded politically charged music from his home in Damascus. But after a fellow musician was killed, he fled to neighboring Lebanon.
The Syrian uprising was going somewhere really dark. So at some point, there was no job for people like me. I'm not the one who would hold weapons.
He spent 2 years living in Beirut. The band had a few regular gigs, but Maghrebi's legal status was in jeopardy. Job prospects were scarce, and the music scene relatively small and poorly funded. It was starting to sink in.
I think there's no future for most of the Syrian youth and the Lebanese youth.
Maghrebi sold almost everything he owned, except his harmonica and an old melodica. He put them in a backpack with a few clothes and flew to Turkey to meet the other members of his band. They had left for Turkey months earlier. Eventually, Maghrebi and his bandmates made the risky journey across the Aegean Sea, arriving on the Greek island of Lesbos.
In Lesbos, the first moment, that was a surreal moment, a really remarkable one, that we landed on a hotel beach. Tourists were tanning on the beach under the sunshine, having a good time. And all of a sudden, this rubber boat with 16 young guys.
Refugees crawling out of boats is now a regular sight on Lesbos. But Hobiz Daule made a different sort of entrance.
We introduced ourselves as a band. We gave them our CDs from the bag.
From there, they followed the thousands of Syrians before them up through Macedonia, into Serbia, and on to Croatia.
In Croatia, we did our first concerts on the way.
Some activists suggested that they play in a refugee camp about 50 miles from the capital, Zagreb. But to Maghrebi's surprise, most of the crowd that showed up were Croatians, not refugees. Word spread about the concert, and the owner of one of the biggest venues in Zagreb asked them to play a show. The next night, Maghrebi and Hobiz Daule played a sold-out concert.
But what happened with these concerts, I started to think, what the word tour, when bands say that, what does it mean? Isn't this a tour?
They were invited to play two more shows in Austria.
We started to get a lot of requests for gigs in Germany and all around Europe.
When I catch up with them, they're in a music shop in central Berlin trying instruments.
Blacktop, Stratocaster,
They're living in a refugee shelter and say the bureaucracy and living off the small amounts provided by the German government is tough. But in Berlin and throughout their journey, they found a community of musicians and artists that welcomed and supported them.
Especially during the journey, they made me almost forget about all these stupid stuff that we invented. Passports, borders, fences.
But those borders are still a real barrier. Habez Daoulay just signed with a booking agent that will organize gigs for them across Europe. A real European tour. But they'll have to wait until June. Until then, they're not allowed to leave Germany. It's a condition of their asylum application, but they say that's fine.
Because the plan originally for all of us to reach to the final destination.
For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard, Berlin.
I could not believe it when I heard about the latest cheating scandal in cycling. Forget about athletes doping their bodies. Now they're doping the bikes. The International Cycling Union, or UCI, found a motor inside a competitor's bicycle. This happened in a cyclocross race in Belgium. It is a tough sport with bikes built to race down dirt roads, mud, sand, and snow, as well as pavement. Now, I'm shocked by this motorized bicycle business, but David Schloss, an editor at Bike Hugger, is not.
I'm not surprised that somebody's put a motor in a bicycle. I am pretty saddened by it. I think that any doping really defeats the point of the competition. This just takes it to a whole new level.
Now, the UCI, the bike governing body, had been laughed at for bringing in X-ray machines to races, apparently, to look for motors. How long have these suspicions been going on?
Well, the suspicions have been going on officially since 2010. That's when the UCI started to actually bring those, you know, airport X-ray scanning machines to bike races and make people disassemble their bikes right before the races began. Comments about it being a possibility started a year or two before that. The UCI had spent 5 years trying to find a motor inside a bicycle. They proved that it was possible in laboratory tests. They just had not found one in the wild, so to speak, and now they have their first case of it.
Yeah, where have the cyclists been hiding the motors?
Well, so it looks like the motor is a combination of a system that's inside what's called the down tube, which is the metal tube that is underneath where the saddle is. So if you think about it, it's a round, hollow object that goes all the way down to where the pedals and the cranks are. So the system is hidden inside of there and is part of the bottom bracket. The bottom bracket is the part that the pedals spin around on an axis. And what the system is able to do is able to turn the pedals for the cyclist and give them extra propulsion. And you really don't need all that much. If you think about it, races are often won by a second or two here and there. So the difference between being a first place finisher and being somewhere off the top 10 might be a matter of 2 or 3 seconds. Really, all you need is a little bit of a boost.
When was the moment when your suspicions were really tweaked, David?
My suspicions were tweaked the first moment that spectators and the magazines and the TV shows all said that it wasn't possible at all, because they all said the same thing about every type of biological doping, that there would be no reason to do it, that it wouldn't provide enough of an advantage, that it was too difficult to get away with. Those are the same things that people said about testosterone and EPO and microdosing and all the things that have plagued this and other sports. So pretty much as soon as the people who are in the industry said, oh, there's absolutely no way that this is possible, that's the point at which I thought it was possible.
There's blood doping, mechanical doping. When are spectators, cycling spectators, just going to throw in the towel with the sport?
Well, honestly, I think a lot of them have already. I have a 5-year-old son, and he and I watched the Tour de France. But the last couple of years, I really stopped showing it to him. I couldn't really justify showing him a sport in which I was so sure that there was so much doping going on. And you look at the times of some of these finishers in the last few years, and they're spectacular. They're some of the fastest times ever in the Tour de France and the Giro. And the last time that happened was Lance Armstrong. It takes a lot of the enjoyment out of the sport. These people are clearly in it to make their income and make their living. But what they're doing is they're taking the enjoyment away from all the spectators.
David Schloss, an editor at Bike Hugger, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Always great to talk to you.
Marco Werman here with The World. Mexican singers have gotten wealthy writing songs for drug barons, the so-called narco corridos. So why shouldn't any other drug baron merchandise be a hot seller? When drug kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman was recaptured by police last month, he already had folklore status. The merchandising of that status was bound to follow. And yes, there have been lots of El Chapo t-shirts and piñatas and pajamas, but not authorized by El Chapo himself. Now comes word that his daughter has been given the approval to legally use her father's name to sell stuff. Simeon Tagle with our partner Global Post is here to tell us more. So Guzman's daughter, Alejandrina Guzman, what is she allowed to sell now?
So she managed to get the term El Chapo trademarked to sell four different lines of products, and that's going to include jewelry, watches, leather products, fake leather products, luggage toys, and even Christmas tree lights.
Christmas tree lights. Wow, what are those going to look like?
I would guess pretty gaudy.
So the trademark office, the patent trademark office in Mexico, apparently denied requests from 20 other family members to register El Chapo, the nickname. Why did it give in to the daughter?
Well, that's a good question. And there were a total of 24 different requests for trademarks from members of El Chapo's family. And they're all for all kinds of different variations of his name. El Chapo Guzman, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, El Chapito Guzman, Don Chapo Guzman. And 20 of them over a period of several years got turned down. But four of them, all for the name El Chapo, which means shorty, by the way, in Mexican Spanish, were approved.
Do you know if there was any hesitation to use the name El Chapo to sell stuff?
Well, the process seems to be pretty opaque. We don't actually know why they were approved. But what is really curious is that the ones that were turned down, reasoning was given that it would be, quote unquote, contrary to morals and good customs, and also that it would have violated Mexico's law of industrial property, which prohibits the trademarking or patenting of aliases or nicknames of anyone who's wanted by law enforcement in Mexico.
So since early January, Simeon, when El Chapo was captured, have you noticed kind of a rise in El Chapo swag around Mexico City?
Yes, it's a booming industry. There's all kinds of El Chapo products, T-shirts all over the place, even piñatas. There are counterfeit goods of all kinds of brands, Tommy Hilfiger, Nike, everywhere. So I'm really wondering whether trademarking El Chapo is going to actually make any money for his family members.
You know, we can chuckle about an El Chapo piñata all we want, Simeon, but El Chapo is responsible for horrific, violent stuff. What does it say that people are willing to shell out good money for T-shirts, for piñatas with El Chapo's face and name?
Well, that's true. I mean, we perhaps shouldn't take this too seriously. A lot of it is humor. But of course, yeah, El Chapo has been implicated in hundreds, maybe even thousands of murders. Extremely brutal individual. And I'm sure some people who might want to buy the official El Chapo products would really regard it as having some form of cachet, the way, you know, you wear any other branded clothing. So it definitely says something a little bit worrying about one sector of society.
A new low for irony, perhaps. Simeon Tagle with our partner Global Post, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
El Chapo and the drug war, a theme you might find in a song by Astrid Haddad. If you don't know Mexican artist Astrid Haddad, you're in for a treat. Haddad has been a star in Mexico since the mid-1980s, when she starred in Donna Giovanni, an all-female version of Mozart's opera. From there, her repertoire has grown in many different directions, including cabaret. Recently, Haddad appeared on stage in New York, and Alex Galifant was there.
Astrid Haddad uses lots of words to describe herself.
Singer, artist.
Costume designer, political provocateur.
What more can I say about me?
That's a lot in one person.
It's what I am. When I began to sing, I realized that it was not enough only to sing. And I became to write about politics. And after, I began to design my own costumes to enforce what I was saying.
An Astrid Haddad cabaret performance is a total artwork, with every element adding something distinctive to the mix. Let's talk about the costumes. Over the course of this performance, Haddad transformed into an Aztec pyramid, a masochist, a flag, and much, much more. The German cabaret of Kurt Weill is an influence, but Haddad's style is much more colorful.
Because Mexico is so colorful, so I said I cannot make this kind of cabaret. So I invented my own kind of cabaret. For that reason, my spectacles are so exuberant. because Mexico is like that.
So the pyramid dress, for example, it was adorned with colorful skulls, like the ones you might see during the Day of the Dead holiday in Mexico. For Haddad, the skulls show how the Aztecs took the horror of death and transformed it
in something sweet, in something different.
Astrid Haddad is almost 60 years old now. She's been a fixture in Mexican culture for decades, but she retains a singularly naughty sense of humor.
I sing ranchero or Mexican music, but in the way of heavy metal.
Or, as she puts it, heavy nopal. Nopal being an edible cactus common across Mexico. For this song, she dresses as a leather-bound sinner and carries a cat-o'-nine-tails.
The song says, like a good Mexican, I will suffer the pain quiet. And I whip myself.
And whip herself she does, leaping about the stage, occasionally pausing to bash her head against what seems to be a rock made of polystyrene. It's epic stuff. Speaking of which, Haddad doesn't forget to address the strange push and pull that exists between Mexico and its neighbor to the north, a relationship for the ages, if ever there was one.
We are good friends. But a long time ago, I wrote the Godfather.
She's talking about the Lord's Prayer, the Our Father.
Holy Father that dwells in another country, blessed be your new order. Let your dollar come to us. Let thy will be done as it is in the north, as it is in the world. Give us today our daily McDonald's. Forgive the immigrants as we forgive the Marines.
Astrid Haddad delivers on her promise, a spectacle that stops people in their tracks.
And liberate us from businessmen and traders. In God we trust. Shalom. Amen.
For the world, Alex Galifant in New York.
Salud, salud. Okay.
Astrid Haddad, I love her. News headlines are up next, and in a bit on the front lines of the battle against ISIS in Libya. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Zika is declared an international public health emergency. Coming up, we find out more about the African forest that gave this mosquito-borne virus its name.
And it's just your average woodlands. They have a lot of green, lush vegetation, variety of trees, and some monkeys.
The Zika forest of Uganda, coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. If you're confused about Zika, we get it. It is confusing. The World Health Organization today declared Zika an international public health emergency. At the same time, other experts suggest the scare may be bigger than the reality. We're going to spend the next few minutes getting some in-depth info on Zika. First up, those big concerns over pregnant women getting sick with the virus because of the possible link between Zika and microcephaly. That's a condition where babies are born with unusually small heads and perhaps brain damage. But there's still a lot we don't know about microcephaly itself, much less its connection to Zika. Listen to this Brazilian woman who was born with the condition. Her name is Ana Carolina Cáceres, and as she told my BBC colleagues, she beat the odds.
No dia que nasci, o médico falou que eu não teria nenhuma chance de sobreviver. Tenho microcefalia. Meu crânio é menor que a média.
On the day I was born, The doctor said I would have no chance of survival. I suffer from microcephaly. My skull is smaller than average. The doctor gave his diagnosis. She will not walk, she will not talk, and over time, she will enter into a vegetative state until she dies. He, like many others, was wrong. My father says that I started walking from one day to the next. When I was one, I saw a puppy passing by and got up to go after it. I grew up, went to school, graduated, and went to university. Today I'm a journalist and I write my own blog. I chose journalism to give voice to people like me who do not feel represented. I can say that today I am a fulfilled, happy woman.
Dr. Ganesh Warren Mochida is a specialist on microcephaly. He's a neurologist at Children's Hospital here in Boston. So just tell us what microcephaly is, a real layman's definition. How and when does it manifest itself?
Mm-hmm. So microcephaly literally means small head. So it's actually not a single disease, but rather a group of many different conditions. So sometimes microcephaly may be noted by prenatal ultrasound. Sometimes it is noted when a child is born and the neonatologist measures the head, even after birth during the first few years of life.
Do we know what causes it?
So there are hundreds of different causes. There are at least several hundred genetic disorders that are associated with microcephaly. Some of the common ones include something like Down syndrome, which is well known to be associated with small brain size. And then in terms of non-genetic causes, there are many congenital infections that have already been strongly linked to microcephaly, like we have been talking about recently in relation to Zika virus.
Right. What is your thought on the connection between Zika virus and microcephaly? And how actively researched has the Zika virus kind of pushed this connection right now?
Right. The definitive link between Zika virus infection in pregnant women and microcephaly is yet to be established, but I think the evidence is mounting. However, the connection has not been raised prior to this outbreak. So there has been really little research about that connection. And actually, we are trying to do more research into this.
According to the Children's Hospital website, there are approximately 25,000 cases of microcephaly in the U.S. alone each year. Should that number surprise us?
Not really. It is actually not that uncommon as you might think. And particularly for pediatric neurologists like ourselves, it is not uncommon to see children with microcephaly visiting our clinic every day.
What does that number look like globally?
There are no good epidemiological data on microcephaly in many other countries, but in each population, depending on their circumstances, the distribution of underlying causes may be quite different. For example, in parts of the world where immunization is not widely available, then congenital infections such as congenital rubella syndrome may be an important cause of microcephaly, although it is fairly rare to see that in the U.S. these days.
What about living with microcephaly? We heard earlier from that woman whose parents were basically told when she was born she wouldn't live long with microcephaly, but the doctors were wrong. How do they survive?
So, as I mentioned earlier, microcephaly just means that someone's head size, meaning the brain size, is smaller than usual. In some cases, that may be just part of the physical trait. So it is entirely possible that someone has normal intelligence and a normal neurological function. But in the severe end of the spectrum, it can be life-threatening and sometimes quite lethal early on in life.
Is there a treatment right now for microcephaly or a cure?
So for most cases of microcephaly, there is no specific cure. But that does not mean that microcephaly cannot be treated. You know, you can intervene with physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy. And because particularly children's brain is so plastic, if you intervene, sometimes you can make a huge difference in these children's development. So it is important to look at the positive side as well.
Dr. Ganesh Warren Mochita, neurologist at Children's Hospital here in Boston, thanks very much for your time and your explanations.
Thank you very much.
When it comes to Zika, a lot of the focus has been on Brazil, but other countries are also struggling with the virus. My BBC colleague Katie Watson traveled to El Salvador, where authorities have just launched a fumigation campaign against the mosquitoes that can spread Zika.
The Zika busters are out in force. Authorities here are trying to take control of this epidemic.
The buzz you can hear is that of the motobomba, which is the big gun, if you like, that's pumping out this chemical with smoke you can see, and it's a really pungent smell. They're not sending in army yet here in El Salvador, but they are sending in armies of municipal workers knocking on the doors of neighbourhoods to fumigate all the houses they can.
Nayib Bukele is the mayor of San Salvador.
Some people are calling it the new Ebola. I don't know if it's the new Ebola, but we don't want to find out. We have to stop this disease. We have to kill this mosquito. And at the end of the time, if scientists find out this, it was the new Ebola, or it should be, or it was going to be, but we don't want to find out with people.
In this small nation of just 6 million people, there have been more than 6,000 suspected cases, 2,500 alone since the beginning of this year. Enterprising market sellers are taking advantage of the growing concern. Colourful electric mosquito-zapping tennis rackets are being peddled as anti-Zika devices in the centre of town. With new cases rising and more quickly every week, the government's having to step up its efforts. The health ministry recently warned women they should hold off from getting pregnant until 2018. It's a statement the politicians have rowed back on, limiting it to just this year. Even so, asking people to put off having a family is a drastic step. Dr. Eduardo Espinosa is the Deputy Health Minister.
We are giving a recommendation. It's not prohibition nor a birth control measure. These children are going to need neurological help for the rest of their lives. They will have to get support, and they will change the family dynamic. Nobody wants a child with disabilities, so we are asking people to reflect.
But this is a hugely conservative society. Abortion, under any circumstance, is banned and can lead to decades in jail. The Catholic Church says the government's approach is misguided, but doesn't offer much support for women in these uncertain times. Father Luis Ayala is a spokesman for the Catholic Church.
No es esto la solución al problema del Zika.
This isn't the solution to the Zika virus, but in light of the risk, a husband or wife can decide not to get pregnant, because if they do and get bitten and realize they might have damaged the fetus, well, they have to avoid the bigger evil, which is abortion.
At the country's biggest maternity hospital, leaflets are being handed out, but there's little sign of panic among medical staff. This is a country well used to viruses like dengue and chikungunya. As I heard one nurse say, Zika is just the fashionable virus right now. But pregnant women here are concerned.
It is a bit scary because nobody wants their kids in those conditions with this illness.
Look, nobody here has come out with a protection kit. Where's the concern? Chatting to people won't get rid of the mosquitoes.
So far, there have been no cases of babies born with microcephaly here in El Salvador, but there are around 100 women who are pregnant and under observation. They won't know the true impact of the virus until their babies are born in a few months' time.
The BBC's Katie Watson reporting there from El Salvador. Crucial to fighting Zika could be a better understanding of its origins. The word Zika, in fact, comes from the place where it was first discovered. That's the Zika forest in Uganda. My BBC colleague Catherine Bayaruhanga is in Kampala, the Ugandan capital. She's been to the Zika forest, but she says most locals have not.
First of all, when you ask Ugandans where Zika Forest is, a lot of them wouldn't tell you because this is just really a small patch of land on the main road between the capital and the international airport. So it's sort of quite forgotten. And it's just your average woodland. So you have a lot of green, lush vegetation, variety of trees, and some monkeys. And really, the monkeys are at the heart of how the Zika virus was discovered. You had scientists working there, some from the United States, Europe, and Africa. They had been funded by the Rockefeller Foundation to do research into yellow fever. So back in 1947, they were testing the monkeys, trying to see whether they had yellow fever and how it was transmitted using mosquitoes. And then they stumbled upon a new microorganism, which in turn they named Zika after this forest in Uganda.
So that was 1947, that outbreak. The mosquitoes were biting the monkeys? Is that what was going on?
Well, at the time, they weren't quite sure. All they knew was that there was a virus in the monkeys. Eventually, they found out that it was being transmitted by mosquitoes. So you can bite the monkeys, get the virus, and then transmit it to humans. But it's quite important to note that the type of mosquitoes in Uganda tend to prefer to bite animals, so not human beings. And the ones that could bite human beings live in forests where they don't really come into contact with the general population. Mm. And that's the reason why, really, according to the Uganda Virus Research Institute, there have only been 2 recorded cases of the Zika disease in Uganda over 7 decades. So that's one of the reasons why there hasn't been an outbreak of the disease in Uganda.
Yeah, so how's the news of the outbreak in Brazil, especially all the reports of microcephaly? How's that being received right now in Uganda? Are people worried that this risk might be present with them as well?
I think a lot of people here are just finding out that the disease was discovered here in the first place. It's really been sort of at the background of the research, the scientific community, mainly because the symptoms have been so mild that researchers here haven't really felt the need to go out to the population and warn them about it. So people here are just learning about it. They're just hearing about it. So we haven't got a sense of fear. And secondly, because there are no reported outbreaks in the country. So people here just think it's not really a disease that would affect them.
What about you, Catherine? Are you looking at mosquitoes a little differently today?
Well, I am, because of the time I spent with the scientists at the Uganda Virus Research Institute. For example, I didn't know that Uganda has over 220 species of mosquitoes in itself. And even in these species, you have different subtypes. So you kind of do look, when I get bitten by a mosquito, I do look at it and think, oh, what kind of mosquito is this? What kind of disease would it spread? And this is a question I asked Dr. Julius Lutwama when we were in the forest. I asked him, how safe is it for us to be here in the forest? And he said, no, it's safe. We've studied the mosquitoes. We do know that the chances of you getting the virus are very slim. But the other point to mention, obviously, is the fact that now there is the potential this could become a global issue, the virus, how it's spreading. So even here, the scientists at the lab say they're going to continuously review the types of mosquitoes in Uganda to make sure that if there are any that can readily and easily transmit the disease, they're on standby to put in place measures that would prevent an outbreak.
My BBC colleague Catherine Bayaruhanga has visited the Zika forest in Uganda. She's been speaking with me from Kampala. Thanks so much, Catherine.
Thank you for your time.
A little music now from Uganda to take us to the break. This is from a few years back, one of the first recordings put out on Peter Gabriel's Real World label. It's Ugandan musician Jeffrey Oryema, a 1990 album I love called Exile. An autobiographical title, Oryema's father was a cabinet minister under former dictator Idi Amin. When Jeffrey was 24, his father was killed, many believe, on the orders of Amin. So Jeffrey Oryema fled Uganda in 1977 in the trunk of a car. That's when he began his life of exile. Here's a track from the album Exile called Yeah Yeah Yeah. I I get a Brit to explain the caucus system to me so we Americans know what we're looking at tonight. That's just ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Mention Benghazi, and most Americans recall the attack in 2012 that killed the U.S. ambassador to Libya and three other Americans. The city in eastern Libya is still being rocked by violence. The fight now pits a coalition led by the Libyan army against Islamist militias and the so-called Islamic State. My BBC colleague Ben Allen traveled to Benghazi and sent back this update.
One, two, three. Go! Go, go!
We join fighters as they rush to take up positions on the edge of a housing estate.
Go, 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 go. Come.
These armed men are working with the army, battling to stop the advance of Islamist militias here in Benghazi. As the front lines shift, whole neighborhoods become conflict zones. We take cover behind what's left of a seven-story apartment building. Most of the families here have left, but a few remain. They have no other options. Benghazi is the birthplace of Libya's uprising. A city that gave hope to an entire nation is now tearing itself apart. The armed forces still control most of Benghazi, but they're losing ground to the Islamists. Just a few hundred meters away from the front line stands a local school. It's been hit by gunfire before, but children here are desperate for an education.
I think that they are suffering a lot.
The head teacher, Fauzia Bey, takes me on a tour of the school. It stopped classes after the fighting started a year and a half ago. It's now a month since it's reopened, and already 400 pupils are back in lessons.
Despite all these conditions, the health, the environment around the school, the snipers, the dangerous, but the parents insist on sending their children to this school to study, despite all these conditions.
As we step inside a classroom, we hear gunfire in the distance. The children no longer react. Life is tough for them. This Islamic State propaganda video shows other Islamist militias in Benghazi pledging allegiance to the group. The influence of IS here is growing. As we drive along the main road into the city, we spot another sign of their presence. Amid destroyed buildings and raised over a minaret, the black and white flag of IS clearly displayed above one of the areas under their control. Back on the front line, night has fallen. The men gather around a fire where a pot of pasta is boiling. All of them here say they'll keep fighting, but as disagreements within the armed forces grow, so does the strength of the Islamic State.
That was the BBC's Ben Allen reporting from Benghazi, Libya. Finally, there is no avoiding it today. It's Iowa time for the 2016 presidential candidates, which means the good people of Iowa are doing that thing they do every 4 years, you know, caucusing. David Taylor is head of news for The Guardian US, and he's at the media center in Des Moines, Iowa right now. So I'm an American born and bred. I know with a caucus, voters are not trudging to the polls throughout the day to cast their ballots. But that is about all I know, David. So since you're a foreigner, you've got to explain this to your readers. I'm going to have you explain it to us right now. How does this whole caucus business work?
All right, well, let me take a stab at it. So, you know, there are some golden numbers here. There are 99 counties in Iowa and 1,681 precincts, which are neighborhoods like any rural community. And we're going to be seeing this evening people coming together in their communities at gymnasiums, school halls, churches. And it's on either side of the political divide, it's going to be a night that starts with speeches. People will be able to stand up and act as surrogates for their favoured candidates. And there's a very different process on either side. So the Republicans, it's quite straightforward in the sense that you hear what people have got to say, and then it's a secret ballot where you write down on a bit of paper who you want to be the nominee, and the world learns in a couple of hours what's going to go on. The Democrats have a far more fiendish, more complicated dance where what's going to happen at a precinct is people will gravitate towards different corners of the room where there will be, as it were, a sort of captain for each candidate, Hillary and Bernie and Martin O'Malley. And the way the system works is you have to have 15% at least of those who are in the room in order to be able to call any Iowa delegates your own. And then there's this curious game goes on where if, let's say, Martin O'Malley, who's way down in the polls, doesn't make 15%, his supporters are going to be invited to either switch sides or go home, and they could gravitate towards Bernie or towards Hillary. And here we are in a democracy, you know, where in a general election, everyone is entitled to their secret ballot. And so different in the caucus, they have to do it in public. You know, everyone can see which camp you're in. You're standing there and it's a head count.
Yeah, and are there literally people like walking over to the other side of the room if, you know, those changes
happen?
Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. We were laughing, my colleagues and I, last night that there's this 1970s children's TV program in the UK called Run Around, where kids have to dash across a TV studio and they line up behind an answer that they want to say is correct. And then at the last minute, they all change sides to try and foil the opposition. So there's the potential for a bit of gamesmanship. So I think people can expect some shenanigans tonight.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if there is any ritual or event in the UK, political or otherwise, through which decisions are made that resemble the caucus system, but you just kind of gave it away.
A children's game show. I think it's if you haven't got it by now, you should look that one up on YouTube.
So big differences from a primary. I mean, this is non-binding. There are no delegates involved and people aren't going out and voting all day, right? Other than that, what are the other differences?
I think it's fair to say that none of us truly understand how the Iowa delegate system works, that this is only the first sort of throat clearing, really, of the state, you know, and then it goes into some smoke-filled rooms where deals may be done. And the suggestion is, you know, that Bernie feels that he's, even if he loses on the night in the vote, he's still got delegates shored up because he knows that he's got, you know, friends in unions and what have you. So I think I'm going to be lying if, although I feel like I might have be on the way to a PhD in caucusing. I would be lying if I said I'd passed it.
David Taylor, head of news for The Guardian US, speaking with me from Des Moines, Iowa. David, thanks very much for the primer on the Iowa caucus. I don't know how I made it out of social studies without it, but somehow I did.
Very good. Well, it was really great to talk to you, and I hope we're all a bit more intelligent on the other side.
And that'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.